All right, y'all, it's spring, and you know what that means. It's time to start planning our summer festival traveling. Yep, it's time to get into my Airbnb bag cross-country, a.k.a. Time to visit my homes all across the country. And you know what I never think about? Why not list my own spot on Airbnb and host some folks at my house? I mean, my house is cute. Yes, let's make money while we're spending money. Just trying to help you out, man, because your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Tired of not being able to get a hold of anyone when you have questions about your credit card? With 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yes, you heard that right. You can talk to a human on the Discover customer service team anytime. So the next time you have a question about your credit card, call 1-800-DISCOVER to get the service you deserve. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
You know you've got a comeback in you. When you take the next step, you're going to make it count. For your career, for your family, for your life. You can earn a degree you're proud of with Purdue Global. Purdue Global is backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected and innovative public universities. This is your chance. This is your opportunity. This is your comeback. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Questlove Supreme is a production of iHeartRadio.
What up, y'all? It's Laia. And we are back with part two of our interview with the incredible, incomparable, trailblazing Robert Townsend. Y'all know this conversation is everything I love about Questlove Supreme. It's funny, informative, and like so heartfelt. Last week, Robert spoke about his inroads to comedy and acting as he delighted us all with a bunch of impersonations. He spoke about working on The Warriors, the movie, y'all, nearly joining SNL, and a deep dive into how he made Hollywood shuffle with a dream and a credit card. So now we're back for part two. Join us as we celebrate Black History Month with an American treasure, Robert Townsend. Part two, taped in studio at iHeart Hollywood. Enjoy, y'all.
Once the success of the film brings you to this platform, what's your internal feelings? Because oftentimes when a person has like that type of success out the box, I mean, we could say this is the Illmatic, Nas situation, whatever.
Right.
Like the follow-up, getting over the mountain. Like in your mind, what are you envisioning your next step to be?
You know what's funny is that I've always known exactly what I want to do, and then it's just that when you, like after Hollywood Shuffle, I was being offered everything in the universe, every project, every script, every da-da-da-da.
What was being offered to you?
It was all kinds of bad comedies. It was like a lot of bad stuff that I wouldn't want to do, and so I was like, you know, when people go like, well, this, you haven't made a lot of films, this is funny. And then it's like, no, it's not funny. And you're dealing with TV Guide because I grew up on television. So there's a certain, I have
what's
my
funny to them.
Yeah. And so I was being offered everything, but there was nothing that spoke to me. And the one story that I wanted to do when I was a kid in Chicago in 1968, Herb Kent, the cool gent, gets on the radio and says, the Temptations are breaking up and David Ruffin is leaving the group. And that was my favorite group. And so I was like, what happened? This is wrong, blah, blah, blah. And so that kind of stayed in my head. And so my thing was, you know, I told Keenan, I said, we could do a story. I wasn't, you know, arrogant enough to say we could get the Temptations story. I said, let's make our own movie, but I want to know what happened.
Right.
I want to know what happened to that singing group. Why did they break up? You know, because I was devastated as a kid. I just remember looking at the radio and I was like going, what? Why did he's leaving? What, you know? And then that took me on the journey for the next movie. But all the stuff that they were offering me, there was nothing that I was really like, you know,
With the Five Heartbeats, you, at the end credits, you mentioned the Dells.
Yes. Kind
of. How involved were they in, you know, with making a movie with you, and how much of the story is from their personal kind of experience?
So let me give you the backstory behind the film. I did a documentary on it. It's called Making the Five Heartbeats. The whole thing that I would say is that initially I wanted David Ruffin and Eddie Kendricks to be the technical advisors. Mm. And so I had reached out to them, and David, he was going through his drug thing. He was struggling. And right. so I went to meet with him, and he was strung out a little bit. And Keenan and I, we said, hey, once the film gets green lit, we're going to put him in rehab. We'll just pay for it and just take care of him and blah, blah, blah. So that was our plan, because I told Keenan, man, David doesn't look good. And he was doing that snorting and all that. And right. I could just tell. And so we were going to, take care, put him in rehab. So anyway, the studio, Joe Roth, finally green lights the movie. And so I go, hey, I got David Ruffin and Eddie Kendricks. And then he goes, no. And I said, well, why not? And he says, because everybody's going to think it's the Motown story. Mm. And you got that Big Red character. And so they're going to say, the Temptations. And you're going to get lawsuits up the wazoo, because people are going to say, oh, this is the Motown story.
Right.
Because you got these two as your technical advisors. And so then at that point, I had to say no to them, which broke my heart. And then they were saying, who else would you want to be technical advisors? And then that's when the Dells, I said the Dells, and then the Dells.
God, you knew Marvin Jr. That's crazy.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God.
Yo, man. Like, I was born, so I wasn't born at a Dells concert, but my mom, like, damn near on the ninth month, but I started kicking at a Dells concert. And so,
are you serious?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I was in the womb. But yeah, I mean, I grew up like I grew up in the Charles Stephanie period of the Dells, so like How Sweet Can Funk Be and all. But yeah, Marvin Jr. like to me, even knowing like the briefly, like my dad knew Teddy Pendergrass, whatever. Like Teddy would even say like that's his North Star. Like what was it like just dealing with it? Because the world does not know about the Dells and how powerful they are.
So the Dells, my favorite singing group, people know Oh What a Night is one of their big, big, big songs, and Marvin singing the long note. And at first, they got pushback from that record because they go, this record is too long, but the DJs eventually loved it because they could take a break, and people love that long note,
right.
And then the whole thing. So the first meeting with the Dells could have been the last meeting, because they were at the Wiltern Theater, and I was like, oh, they're after the whole thing happened with the Temptations, I was like, they're in town. So I'll go talk to them. Now, I don't know how to interview people, so I was never like that. So I do my research before I go there. On their first album cover, they weren't on the cover. It's a white couple walking along Michigan Avenue looking so in love. And so I'm like, and they're on the back in a little square this big. And so then I was like, that's kind of messed up, their first album. And I was like, that's kind of weird. So anyway, I go to the Wiltern. They're getting ready for the show. They're all in their white bathrobes, and they're putting their makeup on and just chilling and everything. And so they're all friendly and nice. Robert Towns is coming to see us, man. Robert Towns, hey, how you doing, Robert? How you doing? And so then we're talking. And so then I'm looking at them, and I'm like going, I said, hey, man, I'm trying to do this movie. I want to get it real about how groups were treated, how much money you made. And I could see their faces changing in the mirror. And I was like, okay, I did say something wrong.
Felt the nerve, yeah.
And so then they were like, yeah, man, yeah, we made money. Yeah, we did. And so then they continued talking. Then I said, your album cover. I said, why weren't y'all on the front page of the album cover? And I don't know. I had just looked at it. Wow. And so then in the mirror, now they're in their 70s, late 60s. And I see Marvin Jr. go. And I go, oh, man, Rob, you shouldn't have brought that up. And then he goes, they made a decision, and we just decided that, that's how they was going to go. And then all of a sudden, it was Vern. Right. And Vern says, they wanted us to cross over. They said it would be good for our audience, and then I forgot, Mickey said, yeah, because they couldn't, they could hear our music, but white people don't want to see our faces. And so they started going back and forth. And then I was like, and I was in the mirror
right.
I was like, because the crossover ain't nothing but
the double cross.
That came from them. And so as they were going through it, and it kind of broke my heart, because they were older men, but then when I was looking through the mirror, because I was sitting back while they were all at the mirrors, but they couldn't see me. But then as I was looking at them, that memory was like it was yesterday. And I was like, oh my God,
pain
these
was
poor,
still fresh.
The pain, because then Mickey said, yeah, man, we went to the barbershop and they clowned us hard, man. Everybody at the barbershop was like, what is this bullshit? And we felt so disrespected and da-da-da-da, but then, you know, they made it up to us and blah, 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 blah. But so that's how the Dales,
yeah,
and that's what the Dales gave me.
So how much of Johnny Carter's life was in the high voice?
Choir boy?
Yeah.
We just took pieces of different, you know, let me say this. The thing of the church and secular music has always been there, so everybody dealt with that. So that's why we, you know, it was that, you know, and which is real, you know, like, hey, you can't serve two masters, you know. So all of that was real.
The actor you cast for, I can't remember his name off the top of my head, but he also played your dad, I think, in
David McKnight.
Yeah.
David McKnight.
He was in Hollywood Shuffle, but then also he played Choir Boy's dad.
Yeah.
David McKnight. No, I love him as an actor.
He was the first actor. Paymoon Rami, he entered when I was in college and I was in speech contest in college. The first time I came to Los Angeles, he was the first person to show me around, David McKnight. And he had just finished a movie called JD's Revenge.
Yes! He was the bad guy.
He was the bad guy. He was JD.
He was the bad guy. Uh-huh.
So, yeah.
Man, do you have another?
I have so many. But
go ahead. Now,
final five heartbeats question. One of the things I remember about that movie, it wasn't even so much about the movie. I remember, because this, Five Heartbeats, what, 91?
91, yes, sir.
I was 12, all right? So I'm watching Teen Summit.
Hey.
Right? You know what I mean? And so, you know, back then, I would just go to the movies. Like, my mother would just let me go to the movies by myself. I'd just go watch. And so I went and saw Five Heartbeats, and I'm like, oh my God, this is the greatest movie ever. You know what I mean? So then later on, I see you guys on Teen Summit and you're like, yo, y'all need to support it. We need whatever. And it really kind of cracked the facade. I was like, oh wow, like this is it not successful? Like, how is it not? This movie is amazing. But I really appreciated just how real y'all kept it. I remember you and Michael Wright, I think he was with it. And they was just like, yo, like, you know, we need to support this. And you were talking about the marketing. And that was just something that, you know, seeing black artists on a platform like BET talking so openly about the struggles that y'all were having on a movie that was in theaters, you know what I mean? Like, that shit was big, you know what I mean? And so I just want you to talk about that, man, and kind of what happened.
Let me just say this. The Five Heartbeats, that's the madness of Townsend on the highest level, because I saw close to 10,000 people to be in that film. You know, I had auditions in three different cities and just trying to make it. I'm co-writing, I'm directing, I'm producing, I'm acting, and so I'm wearing all these hats. And then I'm playing music guy as well, because I had to pick the music and the lyrics have to make sense and learn choreography. So it was like one of the hardest things for me. But I loved every second of it. But again, it's that thing again of like the marketing wasn't what I thought it was going to be, and I wasn't happy. And you know, that was my second movie.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But I've always been like, you know. And so I lost the battle on the marketing. So when the film started to die, I was like, this can't be. And the film died, but it didn't die. It was just...
I was like, do you consider it cult classic? Because to me, it's...
No,
anytime that movie's on, I'm watching it.
Yeah.
Period.
No, I mean, when I say it didn't, the box office numbers.
Right.
But I think because the marketing, people didn't know what they were getting, so we didn't make any money. But then, now it's like over a billion, almost 2 billion clips shared worldwide, because they send me the numbers on, like, people will send the sister scene and they'll send Eddie King and then all the memes of gang and we haven't finished yet.
What does that mean for you monetarily though? That doesn't.
The thing is that it means, but see, so I'll put it like this. No, I do not make any money on the clips, but the brand is... I was not wrong. You know, I mean, I have ideas sometimes, and I think my mind goes, You know, like I will create so many, like right now in my brain there's so many different shows and stuff that I'm working on, but they're all different. And I just, it's like there's a certain touch that I have. Like you can watch movies and I design my movies in such a way that I want you to watch them again and again and again and again. If I've done it right.
Yeah.
If I've done it right. You know, if I've added, like even like movies that I just directed, like BAPS, you know, there's so many people that want to remake BAPS. And
I thought there was a whole thing.
That's a whole other story.
Okay,
that I'll make it up. Yeah, but they want to do it, but it's not, it's got to be right. It's got to be right.
Yeah,
so
Meteor Man.
Meteor Man.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you.
The Little first, Richard.
So wait, wait, real quick, because I want to give props to the youngin that's doing our makeup upstairs, Aaron. She said, wait, did Robert Townsend put the first black action hero on film?
Oh, and with, I was like, Meteor Man.
Yeah, and I was like,
Yeah.
That was me.
I mean, that was you see, the thing is that, again, that's a Trojan horse. It's like when my nephew was really little, Greg Jr., and I was coming back to Chicago, and it was like around Halloween, and I was like, who are you going to be for Halloween? Superman, Batman? And he was like, I can't be them because they're white. And I was, you know, and because like you grew up in the hood, there's a certain, you know, and I was like, no, that's wrong, man. Everybody can be a hero. You know, I like Superman. I like Batman. You could be whatever you want to be. Mm-hmm. And so then I said, oh, I'll create a hero that looks like, you know, looks like him. Yeah.
Man, what was it like having Luther Vandross like act? That's
you
like
know,
one of the
I only
actors.
Yes. Yes, Luther, please. You know, like Luther. That's a whole nother. Because when I got married, you know, it was like we would only play Luther, go to Luther concerts, and all of that. So when
I heard he buses too.
Huh?
We heard he's Johnny Gill said he's a hell of a busser, like the dozens.
Yes. So no, but the thing that I would say is that. You know, when I said, hey, would you want to be in the movie? Because I called him, and he was working with Gregory Hines on an album or something.
Yeah, There's Nothing Better Than Love, yeah.
And so then I said, would you be in the movie? And so then he goes, you want me to be in the movie? And I said, yeah, but I want you to play the bad guy, and I want you to have a gun. And he says, I have a gun? And so he was going through this whole thing, and he says, are you serious? And I said, yeah, we're just in pre-production. He says, will you give me 6 months? And I was like, give you 6 months. And I was like, if you need, you know, I was like, yeah, we'll be ready. But, you know, I'll schedule around your schedule. He said, give me 6 months. And he was heavier then. And then he lost all that weight for
Little
the role.
Yeah.
So when he showed up, I was like
skinny.
No.
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
I want you to be the big guy. Yeah.
No, but he was perfect. But he took it serious. He took it really serious. And we were trying to do some other stuff. So it broke my heart when he passed.
Oh, another actor. One thing I always appreciate you, like kind of like with Spike, where you have your kind of crew of actors that you keep working with.
Yes.
And one guy that I always love, man, Roy Fagan.
Roy Fagan is a beast.
Dude, he was like, I met Roy. I was like,
shoot.
So he was
Bird.
Bird
in Midnight Falcon. Yes! He got dangled out the roof. That's Roy.
So, I met Roy. This was, man, I was a kid. I'm like 13 years old. And I went to, he was doing a play in my city in Greensboro, North Carolina. He was doing a play at, it was an A&T. Which is the HBCU in our city. And he was on a play there, and afterwards, I just went down in the front row, and, you know, the cast came out, and I just started chopping up with him and talking about acting and, like, kind of like, what is it like? What is it being? And he was just giving me game. He's like, oh, man, you know, you seem like a smart kid. You know, you got a nice commercial look. You know what I mean? Like, he was cool. And I always respected that and remembered that. And I just wanted to know, what was it like working with him? Because I always loved y'all working together.
Roy was the... was the bad guy in Hollywood Shuffle that was like, don't sell out.
Then he sold out.
Which really happened in real life. That's something that Keenan and I wrote, because we were at an audition. This guy messed our heads up. He was like, brother, don't go in there, man. They trying to get some brother to sell out again. And me and Keenan like, really, really? And then he went in there with that same kind of energy. But no, Roy's just a great actor. I mean, you know, like even in Meteor Man playing the bad guy, you know, he's just a really versatile actor.
Yeah, man, that's what's up.
Can you talk about why you decided to do this in D.C.?
There was a part of me that the whole thing of Washington justice. Yeah. So that's why I wanted to ground
episode.
It there.
Yeah. Okay. All right.
You're from Atlanta last episode. So.
I was born at Howard University Hospital, sir.
Okay. All right. So DC, I get it.
Yo, what's up? This is Fonte, Fontigolo from Team Supreme. Black representation in media is very important to me. I think it's important to have our stories told by people who look like us and who have shared in our common experiences. Some of my earliest influences were Donnie Simpson. I would also say Tom Joyner, Angela Stribling, Sherry Carter. They were just people who told our stories with a lot of class and dignity and were big inspirations to me. The next generation of influential Black voices can be found on NPR's new collection, Black Stories, Black Truths. Black Stories, Black Truths is a celebration of Blackness from NPR. Each of NPR's Black voices are as distinct, varied, and nuanced as the Black experience itself. In the Black Stories, Black Truths collection, you'll hear stories of joy, resilience, empowerment, and creating world-shifting things out of struggle. Every episode is a living account about what it means to be Black today, told from a unique Black perspective. From Bobby Shmurda to The Wire, Michelle Obama to reparations, there's no limit to the range of Black stories, Black truths. Black perspectives haven't always been centered in the telling of America's story. Now, they are the story. In NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, you'll find a collection of some of NPR's best podcast episodes celebrating the Black experience. Hear a feed of episodes from across NPR's podcast, The Center Black Voices. It's NPR Noir. Listen now to Black Stories, Black Truths from NPR, wherever you get podcasts.
All right, y'all. You know what season it is. 'Tis the season for spring breaking and planning our summer travel. And if you're like me, you're already in your Airbnb app trying to find which spot is right for you. Now, listen, while I'm looking to spend all this money, what I'm not doing is thinking about making money with Airbnb. See, you got to change your mind state. Make the money while you're spending the money. How, you say, Laia, do I make the money? Well, you host at your house. And I know what you're thinking. I mean, my whole house? No, you don't have to do your whole house. I mean, you could do a room or, you know, do the whole house. So make some money while you're spending some money this summer. I'm trying to tell you, your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Tired of not being able to get a hold of anyone when you have questions about your credit card? With 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yes, you heard that right. You can talk to a human on the Discover customer service team anytime. So the next time you have a question about your credit card, call 1-800-DISCOVER to get the service you deserve. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
I want to talk Raw, but it just hit me. He's responsible for probably one of my best known songs in my canon. He's responsible for Sometimes.
Blau?
Mm. Okay, so here's the story.
Blau?
Here's the story.
Okay, okay.
And it just hit me right now. You directed Carmen the hip hop opera.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
So here's the deal. Now, you know, I'm doing residency at Electric Lady Studios, and basically D'Angelo and I, you know, get along famously, form a friendship, and he's like, yo, when I make my second album, I need you to be my co-pilot. We're going to start working on the Voodoo record. So from like 96 till 2003, we set up in the house of Hendrix. Jimi Hendrix in the Village, and that's our operation. So all these albums are coming there. The Roots are making their records there. D'Angelo's making his records. Erykah Badu. Anyone that's in that soul query and neo-soul bubble. And so we're working on Common's Like Water for Chocolate album. And he's coming in with an extra pep in his step today. He's like, yo, man. He's like, I got an audition, man. It's the order. Yo, man. I was like, what is it? And he's talking about, yeah, man, you know, I'm going to be an investigator, like and a cop in this hip hopper, and old girl gonna be in this too. I'm like, who's old girl?
Beyonce.
He said, you know, old girl from Bill. Oh, Destiny's Child, you want? Yeah, like we didn't know her name. Whatever. and so we, now the thing was, even though I'm the guy who, I'm the planner, I'm the bridge, I'm the person that introduces people and all that stuff, it wasn't like my intent, but by year three, I realized, like, okay, when I throw jam sessions, I'm bringing people together. And when I'm producing people, I'm bringing these musicians together. And I thought about it. I said, yo, if Common gets this part in this role, then old girl, I'm gonna bring her into our world. Like, I was like, all right, Beyonce, I'm going to bring her into our world. And so think of the sitcom switch thing. So he comes in the next morning. He has like his sweater on, his tie, everything, his hat. Like he's coming to audition. He's not coming in his pajamas. Like, you know, we'll sleep there for 5-6 hours, whatever. And so Common, he's coming in all excited. Like, yeah, man, I'm going to knock this audition out, whatever. And we're like, all right, good luck, good luck. And we're looking like, yo, you think he's going to get it? He's like, no, he ain't going to get it. But anyway, so think of the sitcom switch where it's like, you can do it, you can do it. Switch, and he comes back and all dejected. I was like, what happened? You get the role? Nah, man. Most audition too, man. He's going to get it. So we got jokes. So that whole time, we're just watching our dreams deferred, our dreams just like sail away. And basically what happens is we can't stop clowning Common about losing his role, acting with old girl. So we just start mocking Bills, Bills, Bills. And all the main line in Bills, Bills, Bills is, I don't think you do. So that just became this ongoing joke for 12 hours. Like, we play something, say, no, Common, I don't think you got that role. So we're just going on all day and all day. And then once Most gets the role, then we really start mocking him by, like, Umi Says by Most Def. My Umi Says. So for some reason, James Poyser decided to amalgamate the two songs, Bills, 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 and Umi Says. And we did it for, like, 20 minutes for fun. And the Bilal's like,
yo, that's your jam,
man. I like that. And we're like, nah, man, it was cool. All right, let's figure out a new song. And no, he's like, no, go back to what y'all was just doing. And eventually, our mocking of Bills, 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 and Umi Says is like one of Bilal's most loved songs sometimes. Hell yeah. But
best Bilal song of all time.
Even then.
That's how that song came out?
Yeah, but even then, maybe 60% of his vocals was just a one, you know, like Steve was our engineer at the time. Like basically, like he just took a 57 mic and was just singing anything.
I wish I wasn't me.
And literally, that's how that song, but it was based on Common's experience with
losing
with
out the most.
Carmen, right. It just hit me. You're directly.
What was that like, man, directing that? Doing that, like that shit was crazy.
I like taking on, you know, chances and trying different things. And when MTV approached me about doing a hip hop opera, I was like, ooh, that sounds a lot of fun. And initially they didn't want Beyonce because they were like, has she ever acted before? And so there were certain executives that were giving me pushback. So here's the story. So then I have to go to New York to have the audition there. She's doing something in New York, and I say, you know, we'll have her audition at the MTV office in New York, you know, with the big windows and all that stuff. So anyway, she comes in, and she comes in with a bodyguard because she's in Destiny's Child, and she comes in with some A&R woman. And so when she comes in, I could see she's nervous. And I was like, oh my gosh, she's nervous. And I'm like, I had seen her. I had hosted some event in Cincinnati with Destiny's Child. And I go, she is really charismatic. That, you know, I didn't know her name either, like Beyonce. But I was like, that girl, that one singer is really charismatic. You know, I could just tell when the camera likes somebody. So anyway, I go, no, she should do it. And it's like, Robert, you know, you want to get an actress. You know, she's never acted before. So then she shows up, she's nervous. And so I go like, oh man, all the executives, you know, I don't want them to think, you know, they got me on this one. So I go, she goes, yeah, I mean, I've never acted before and so on, so on, so on, so on. So then I flipped the script. I said to the bodyguard, I said, you're going to be acting in the scene. And then I said to the A&R woman, you're going to be acting in the scene. And then they got really, Mr. Townsend, I don't act, Mr. Townsend. You acting today. Right. And so then he grabs the script and he's shaking. And then A&R woman, she's nervous.
Stephanie?
I think it's Stephanie,
yes.
And so she's nervous, and then I see Beyonce get relaxed. And so then she gets relaxed. And then I was like, okay, so we're going to do the scene now. And this is the scene where you get shot. And I go, you get shot in the hip and you're going to turn around. You're going to spin around and so on, so on, so on, so. And she goes, yeah, let's do it again. Let's do it again. And we and she had those red bottoms on rolling around the floor in her suit and everything. And she goes, I don't care. I don't care about that. And we were doing it again and again and again. And I just remember I showed the stuff to the studio, and they were like, you're right, she is. I said, she hasn't acted before, but I said, she does her music videos, but this is a hip-hop. And so when we were on set, the only thing that got tricky was that she was really a baby. She had never been in a relationship. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. She was a baby that blew up. And so she was concerned about the kiss scene. Because she had to kiss Mekhi Phifer. And so she would be like, oh, do I really kiss him? I said, well, it's a kiss. You got to kiss him. And so then she was just so shy because she's a baby. So anyway, so every day she would ask me when we were shooting, is it today? And I says, no, the kiss doesn't happen today.
She's working
every
off
day.
Like a prisoner.
Yeah, she was like, and it was like, it's day 7. No, it's not today. You know, day 8. No, it's not today. Day 15, it's today. And she goes, oh. Oh, and so I said, just give me a good kiss. But she is not, you know, I said, watch me kiss my hand. And I do the whole hand kiss and I do the whole thing, you know, just to show her because she wasn't. And so then Mekhi wasn't helping because he's going like.
Right.
Ready.
I cannot wait. Come on, girl. Come on. Don't be shy. And so then, you know, it was like comedy because then I said, kiss him. And she goes. And I go, no, you got to kiss him a little bit longer.
Church kiss. How's like Chevelle does it?
Yeah, right.
How long, Robert? Like 3 seconds. 3 seconds. And
she
so
is
then,
counting in her head.
And then she's like,
1,000.
And so I said, no, you got to kiss him. And you know, I said, give me one juicy one and we're out of here.
Rock balls.
Give me one. You know what I'm saying? Give me one juicy one.
Hey, Rock Nation, don't come after me. That's Sugar Steve talking.
Yeah, come after me.
And so she finally does it and then it comes together. But I just remember, you know, like now when I see her, I was like, oh, she has grown. And when I watched her in Cadillac Records, I mean, you know, she's just, but I saw it back then, even when we were in the studio recording the rap.
Did she look at any Dorothy Dandridge stuff, or did anybody even?
I think I told her not to because I wasn't trying to compare performances because she just, you know, I could see she was a natural. She just needed, like I said, that little switch of the people acting opposite her made her relax, and then I saw it. And then when we were on set, it was just fun.
I wanted to ask you about a project that it never came out, not to my knowledge, the Sonny Liston movie that you were working on with Ving Rhames.
Oh, it was a company out of Canada, so it had like a really small release. I'm really proud of that movie.
Yeah,
let me say this. Ving Rhames is an amazing actor, and he doesn't get all the respect, you know. So what happened was I worked with him on the film Holiday Heart with Alfre Woodard, and she got nominated for the Golden Globe for her performance. And Ving, he had just come off of Baby Boy, but then he was playing this gay man. And I mean, he was just brilliant in it. Brilliant, brilliant. So after we got finished with the film, he says, hey man, I'm working on this movie in Canada with this small production company. It's the Sonny Liston. He goes, I don't like this director. I'm spoiled because I got to work with you, and you know, people really love, you know, working, you know, our chemistry as a working team. And so then I flew to Toronto and we shot the movie up there. It's available on DVD, but it's like a small production company out of Toronto.
Yeah, so, I mean, I saw it. I mean, this been years ago. Like I saw it, but I always wondered why it never, you know.
Yeah, because there was something about there was stuff going on behind the scenes with the money. And I, you know, with the production company, but Ving does an amazing job.
I enjoyed the movie, man.
Thank you so much. Can you
talk about the process of Raw? Because the thing is, if someone asks you to shoot a concert film, you really can't reinvent the wheel,
right?
But is there a pressure on you? Because I mean, by that point, I know that for certain comedians in the 60s, Cosby albums are their North Star. Prior albums are, you know, the North Star of 70s comedians. And, you know, Delirious was pretty much like people knew was an instant classic the second it came out.
Right.
So in your mind, are you like what's the planning process for Raw? And, you know, and that how did you have the wherewithal to know who Samuel Jackson was, or Bud?
Deion Richmond,
or Ashley.
Tatiana
Ali. Yeah. Like, you have in that opening sketch, like, these are established.
The next 30 years.
Right.
But see, but you know what it is? It's kind of like, I have laser eyes when it comes to casting. Like, my eyes are like laser focused. So even back then, I'm looking and I can tell when people really have the talent, they really have the gift. And like Sam, I just knew he had something special. I could just tell. And I was like, oh, he can improvise. He can do whatever. And then with the kids, there's a reason why people are stars. There's a certain look. There's a certain energy. There's a certain frequency. Mm-hmm. So when I'm casting, I cast on people's energy. And so even back then, those baby actors, they had that little spark, and I saw the spark. With Sam, you know, I see a lot of actors, and some actors are not magical. You know, I mean, I'm hard on talent, you know, because, I mean, if I've casted right, then they will be perfect for the role. If I've done my job, and you go like, there's something extra going on. Like, people don't know that there's extra sauce going on. Like Babs, for example, Natalie, who played opposite Hallie, mm-hmm. The studios wanted me to cast whatever black actress was on television at that time. And it's like, well, she's hot. She can get on The Tonight Show. She can get on Letterman. She can get on so-and-so and so-and-so. And I was like, no, it's got to be about chemistry. And she happened to be in an acting class with Faison Love. And Faison goes, there's this girl that's in my acting class that I think could be perfect for your movie. And I said, you know, I'll meet her at your house. And we did a 2-hour improv doing all the scenes from the film. And so I was like, I finished doing the improv with her, and I was like, she's the star. She's the one who's going to be in the film with Hallie. I call the studio, and the studio goes, Robert, she hasn't made a movie before. You know, what do you mean, some unknown with Hallie? I said, would you just look at her, please? Just look at her. I think she's got something special. So anyway, he says, well, bring her to the callbacks, whatever. So we have the callbacks, and I'm scouting locations that day. So I've got the top black actresses from television, movies, theater, all waiting for a callback. Now, nothing against any of them, but I need a certain chemistry with, you know, this is Hallie's first real comedy. Yeah. So I'm like, she's going to be a fool in it, and I need to create a comedy team that we've never seen before. So I get there, Natalie is a nervous wreck, you know, and I come in, and I go, hey, everybody, thank you guys so much. Sorry, I was running late. We were scouting, blah, blah, blah. And so then I look at Natalie, and she's like, Rabbit, you know. And so I pull her to the side. I said, come here, girl, come here. And she's like, you know, like, I know half these actresses from TV and movies. What am I doing here, Robert? What am I doing here? This is a big mistake. I ain't never done nothing. So anyway, I said, would you just relax and just be cool? So I said, don't worry about that. Be who God made you to be. Just walk through that door. So anyway, she walks through. We bring all the other actresses in. She walks through the door. The whole time, we're sitting behind a table like this. Hallie's on this side, executives over here, other people. And Hallie has the script reader read with everybody, and she's just watching, and she'll read, you know, blah, blah, blah. When Natalie comes in, shaking a little bit, she goes, hi, y'all. This is my first big audition. I hope, you know. And then Hallie gets up from behind the desk and walks up and hugs her and says, let's read together.
That's what we do. All right, y'all. You know what season it is. Tis the season for spring breaking and planning our summer travel. And if you're like me, you're already in your Airbnb app trying to find which spot is right for you. Now, listen, while I'm looking to spend all this money, what I'm not doing is thinking about making money with Airbnb. See, you got to change your mind state. Make the money while you're spending the money. How, you say, Laia, do I make the money? Well, you host at your house. And I know what you're thinking. I mean, my whole house? No, you don't have to do your whole house. I mean, you could do a room or, you know, do the whole house. So make some money while you're spending some money this summer. I'm trying to tell you, your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Tired of not being able to get a hold of anyone when you have questions about your credit card? With 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yes, you heard that right. You can talk to a human on the Discover customer service team anytime. So the next time you have a question about your credit card, call 1-800-DISCOVER to get the service you deserve. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
AT&T connects an ode to podcasts. Connect the alarm. Change the podcast you stream. Connect the snooze. 10 more minutes to dream. Connect the shower. Lather up with the news. Sports talk, comedians, or movie reviews. Connect with that 3-hour philosophy show. Change the drive into work and traffic so slow. Connect the dishes to voices that glow. Thank you to the geniuses of spoken audio. Connect the stories. Change your perspective. Connecting changes everything. AT&T.
Okay, so this is what I want to ask you advice-wise. So when my dad taught me how to audition musicians, which is you pick the simplest ballot ever and make them audition the easiest ballot ever. Like think of something simple like Color My World by like Chicago or whatever. Just something very, it's almost like Chop 6 level of easy. And he tells me, and I would say, Dad, why do we got more intricate songs in the show. Like, let's audition that. He says, no. He says, because a ballot will reveal to me, like a musician will fall apart if he can't just do the simple task of, you know, wow, so it's like, forget the 7-8 meter.
And all the feels and all of that.
And even now, like with my group, if I present something really intricate, they'll put their mind power to study, you know, but if it's just do nothing except this every 3 seconds, it's the hardest thing in the world. What is the director's equivalent of that in the audition process? Because in about 3 months, I'm about to go through this process, and I don't know what to look for or cheat codes to they have it, they don't have it. Like, what do you look for when you – is there a specific go-to?
So let me
your
say
bowl
this.
Bowl of fruit.
No. I mean, here's the it's easy. I make it very easy. The first thing is that I don't touch the actors initially. I don't even, you know, I said, let me see your instincts. Let me see how you see the role. Let me just see your instincts. I don't even direct them initially. So then they'll go like, I want to do, and I just go, relax, breathe. Like right now, breathe, relax. Take your time, close your eyes, okay? Whatever is stressing you, worried about, get it off of you, shake the energy out, shake it out. Here we go, settle. Do whatever you want to do. Here we go, and action. So now.
I ain't be got no weapon. No.
I ain't be got no weapon.
No, but so once I see their natural instincts, I can see if they, you know, it's kind of like probably with musicians, you can see that little magic or little flair or something, and you go like, oh, there's something there. I let them do that, and then I start to play. Then I go, oh, I love what you're doing. Hey, can you do Ain't Be Got No Weapon again, but this time I want you to take your glasses off and put them on and go, I ain't be got no weapon. And then I'll just give them like little things to play with. And then I'll just start, you know, I'll get on their frequency. So part of it is like getting on their frequency because it depends on the role. Like, I had a scene. There's a movie I did that I'm really proud of. And it was like this little film called In the Hive. It's with Loretta Devine, and it was Michael Clark Duncan's last movie.
Wow.
And she was nominated for the NAACP Image Award for Best Actress, and, you know, and the movie was so powerful, and there's scenes with him in there so powerful. We played a scene at his funeral when he passed.
Wow.
The family was like, could you play this scene? Because it just showed him. But here's my directing style. I'll give you just like a little tidbit. So anyway, there's a young actor. He's 20. But he hasn't done anything, and he's got this monologue. He's playing a kid that's supposed to be 14, but he's old. He looks really young. So anyway, there's a scene where it's based on a true story of this woman in North Carolina who was the cook of the school, and when all the kids were getting kicked out for drug dealing and gangbanging, she says, I'll take them. Mm. Mm-hmm. I'll teach him. And she starts a school with this football player played by Michael Clark Duncan. So anyway, the kid has a long monologue where he's supposed to break down and cry. And so he couldn't cry for some reason. And I only do like three takes. I never do more than three, maybe four if the camera has a bobble or something. I only do three takes. And I was up to 12. Ooh. And so the crew is looking at me like, Rob, he ain't going to cry. We are not going to get it. So then I have to dig into my bag of tricks. So then I say to him, I said, you're working with Michael Clark Duncan and Loretta Devine and Robert Towns is directing you. I said, who is not with us that would be so proud of you right now in this moment? So he goes, my Aunt Betty. And I said, your Aunt Betty. And so I said, you know what? I said, Loretta, can you come over here? Now, Loretta was on Broadway in Dreamgirls. And so I said, Loretta, can you sing Precious Lord?
Oh, Lord.
And we're going to do. And so she starts to sing, Precious Lord, take my hand, lead me on, let me stand. And so I said, we're here at Betty's funeral, and she is so proud of her nephew who is working on this movie. Roll cameras. Here we go.
Right.
A camera, let's go, please. Here we go. Background. Here we go. Settle. And action. Now, here's the part. He starts doing it. The scene is perfect. He's crying the whole thing. But this is where it gets messed up. He couldn't stop crying.
It's too much. Yeah.
He released so hard. He says, I had never cried at her real funeral. He goes, I never released. And I just held him, you know. And so, like, certain times as a director, because, you know, I have the arsenal, I felt bad because he got the performance. I got the performance I wanted, but he had never really released at his own. The same thing happened with Natalie Cole when I was working on the Natalie Cole story about her life.
Yeah.
And she had a monologue, and I just remember, she had a monologue because she was talking about her father. It was like Angel on My Shoulder for NBC. Mm-hmm. And so Natalie, she had this monologue because she's in it, performing in it, and she's also doing the narration. She goes, my father was such a powerful man. When he would sing his songs, I remember so-and-so. And she did it really perfectly. And that part of my brain where, like, that extra sauce comes in, I go, he really lived. He really lived. And she goes like, and we go behind the green screen and she's crying in my arms because she goes, I forgot my father. Because it's all like, Nat King Cole,
right,
unforgettable.
Yeah.
And then she goes like, I said, this moment here is really about you talking about that real man rather than like my father.
The human
it was like
being. Right, yeah.
Like if you talked about your father or your mother, whatever, you would go, my mother, you would go like my mother was. And she released and then we cleaned her makeup up and did the whole thing and then we did it again and it was grounded and it was real. But it's like sometimes like for you, if you're talking about directing or creating and stuff, you gotta get on that frequency of the actors.
The actress was Who played her? I remember
Teresa Randall.
Teresa Randall. Yeah, man.
She was really good. She was really good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. How was it working with her?
Wonderful. Well, I mean, we had so many, because she was, you know, it's like when an artist lives a life and you talk about surrounding yourself with good people, and there were certain people in her life that were like snakes and took advantage. And so we would have those real conversations, which breaks your heart because there's a constant learning curve. Mm-hmm. Like you got to learn this world. You got to learn, okay, hey, so-and-so, the business manager. Okay, so-and-so, the agent. So-and-so, my lawyer. Can I trust them? Oh, my best friend. Is she really my best friend? Or does she hate me? You know what I mean? Friend of me. You know, so you know, it's stuff like that that just kind of breaks your heart.
Man. You have a favorite Natalie Cole song real quick?
Inseparable.
Mine's okay. LaCosta.
Look, I was about to say LaCosta. That's my jam.
I love that one too. My mother, I watched that movie. My mother, me and my mom actually watched that movie together now I think about it. Natalie Cole was her favorite singer.
Yeah.
And Nat King Cole was my granddad's favorite singer.
Oh, man.
So
no, Nat King
was
Cole,
like,
yes.
Again, man, you really created those moments that like really brought like generations together, man, like for real.
I heard a story from Keenan or someone in Keenan's family saying that initially, did the MPAA board wanted to give Raw an X rating?
Yeah, that's true. I do a whole story about that because basically you asked me like, what was the hardest thing? You know, like when you're working on Raw, you got a comedian that's a genius and Eddie is a genius. And so I talk all the time when I direct, when you cast really well, you direct like this. That's all I do. That. If I've cast really well, that's all I do. So Eddie's a master comedian. So you can't really direct him. You can give him notes and make an adjustment. Hey, you could be a little bit more animated when you do that bit. Hey, I'm going to be on your face here, so just give me a little bit of... So I said, you know, you could go a little bit further with the body here. So
how many shows did you shoot?
Two. Wow. At the Paramount Theater in Madison Square Garden.
Okay.
And so we did the two shows. So anyway, we do the two shows. We're all excited, happy. I put my cut together. I show the cut to Keenan. Keenan loves it. We make adjustments. I show it to the studio. The studio loves it. I show it to Eddie. Eddie loves it. Everything is great. We're going to have a big hit. The studio calls back. We got a problem. We got a big problem. We showed it to the ratings board, and they've given it an X rating. You're going to have to recut everything.
What?
And Eddie was like, nah, I ain't cutting shit. Bullshit. And so then he goes, I ain't cutting nothing. And so then the studio's like, look, Eddie, we can't release an X-rated film. Eddie, they're willing to work with us, Eddie. They're willing to work with us. And so then we had to have this emergency meeting at Eddie's house, and we have the lawyers from Paramount and the lawyers from the ratings board, and they're all around this long table in Eddie's house, and they've counted every curse word in the film. And, you know, he's got a lawyer. There's 72 motherfuckers, 52 bitches, 13 cunts, and various cocksuckers. So let's begin. And so then, are you taking that motherfucker, or are we taking that motherfucker?
How many motherfuckers for an R?
And so we go back and forth. We go back and forth, and we negotiate, and then we finally
get line for line, you guys had to negotiate.
Yeah. And then Eddie would get upset. Then Eddie goes like, no, I need that motherfucker. I'll give you two bitches and a hoe for that motherfucker. And so we go back and forth, and then he goes, we finally have an R. I know, this is good. I think we're almost there. And so they go through the whole thing.
What is it like to have it and then suddenly you have to dissect and...
Well, you know, I mean, here's the thing. It's part, you know, the film is called Raw, and it really was raw. He had, you know, Eddie's a genius, man. He's a genius. So there was no filter. And it was like, but it was like having a front row to watch pure genius. I mean, he's still that guy. Right. So it's like watching pure genius.
I know this is kind of a ridiculous concept, but did anybody bring up the idea of like a clean version of Raw? Like, was that even like an option?
No. At that point, Eddie was a rock star.
God.
Mm. Yeah, but I'm saying the way you can release a song now that's like a clean version and a regular version.
People ask me all the time, how much did you cut out? And it's like, yeah, we cut out a bunch of stuff, but it was like being a surgeon. Like, okay, take this one out. Take that fuck out. Because he did, you know, the Italian guys grabbing their ball. You know, he did, I mean, he was just on some, just, he's a genius. But we couldn't do, it would have just been beep, 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 beep.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Is there a director's cut in your layer?
I wish there could be a director's cut, but I mean, that was so long ago. And then after we went through cutting, you know, it would be a nightmare to try to figure it out.
All right, y'all. You know what season it is. 'Tis the season for spring breaking and planning our summer travel. And if you're like me, you're already in your Airbnb app trying to find which spot is right for you. Now, listen, while I'm looking to spend all this money, what I'm not doing is thinking about making money with Airbnb. See, you gotta change your mind state. Make the money while you're spending the money. How, you say, Laia, do I make the money? Well, you host at your house. And I know what you're thinking. I mean, my whole house? No, you don't have to do your whole house. I mean, you could do a room or, you know, do the whole house. So make some money while you're spending some money this summer. I'm trying to tell you, your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Tired of not being able to get a hold of anyone when you have questions about your credit card? With 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yes, you heard that right. You can talk to a human on the Discover customer service team anytime. So the next time you have a question about your credit card, call 1-800-DISCOVER to get the service you deserve. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
AT&T connects an ode to podcasts. Connect the alarm. Change the podcast you stream.
connect the snooze, 10 more minutes to dream. Connect the shower, lather up with the news. Sports talk, comedians, or movie reviews. Connect with that 3-hour philosophy show. Change the drive into work and traffic so slow. Connect the dishes to voices that glow. Thank you to the geniuses of spoken audio. Connect the stories. Change your perspective. Connecting changes everything. AT&T.
We can go through your entire canon, but we would be here for 12 hours.
Man. But we got to add the bear.
Yeah, I was going to say, you playing Ayo's father. Like,
yeah, man.
What is it like?
You know, let me say this.
Love it.
Nah, man. I was so happy.
Here's the thing. It is so well written, so well directed, produced, wonderful talent, cast. So, you know, it for me, you know, she loves me from the parenthood. She was like, that was my show growing up and blah, blah, blah. And I was like, oh. And so when they reached out, I was like, I'd love to. And here's the thing. I was watching the show before they even called and said, hey, would you like to be a part of the world? Because it's just so, I just like quality, man. And it's a quality show. And so I don't know what's going to happen in the next season, but, you know, everybody's, you know, loving it. And I just feel blessed to be a part of it.
Yeah, I was going to say, and we got to get her on the show. I saw Bottoms this weekend, and she's like, that's a Star is Born moment.
Band camp thing, too, right? She got a couple things going
on. Yeah, well, she has everything going on. She's doing stuff with Tyler and all that stuff. But, man, I know this is going to be one of those things where when you leave, then we're just going to be going back and forth.
We forgot about this.
Did I exhaust everything?
You still teaching at USC?
I'm a professor, yes.
Okay, and the class is?
I'm directing. Let me say this. I'm tenured at USC directing. And so let me say this. I think I'm like probably one of the few professors where I have more students in my class than are registered.
I was about to find out because you can just go sit in.
People come and sneak
in.
Yeah,
people come. Well, the students, you know, reach out.
Me.
They love, you know. Here's the thing, you know, it's kind of like I want everybody to live their dream, and my philosophy is that if you want to direct, write, produce, you can do it. You just got to be willing to go the extra mile. So a lot of the students, I see their hunger, like they want it. And then sometimes there's professors that don't know how to reach them or communicate. And the students that I have, you know, and I just feel, I mean, you know, like when you're a kid and you go like, when I grow up, I'm going to be an actor, a writer, a director, a producer, and a professor.
Yes.
And I'm literally.
All the things.
I'm doing all of it.
You know what I mean? And so the students, I love it when they have their breakthroughs. And so my babies, they're all, you know, they're my babies, my cinematic babies. And they're having, like one of my students, Christian, won the DGA award for a student. And I was like, and I work with that boy, and I was just like, he won, and I was like, he's really good. So I just feel blessed.
Speaking of your babies, we got to talk about your baby.
Oh Jesus, Sky! Yeah. Shout out to Sky also. What is it like to see her level of comedy is frightening to me because what she's like, she's. When she jumps into those characters,
yeah,
like there's, I know people that can jump into characters, especially like I've been at 30 Rock for like 15 years now. And so watching people like the level of improvisation that like if any of those SNL, Fallon, like anybody in that stratosphere, they get into a circle, they just start improvising like it's the magic, like the Harlem Globetrotters, like that sort of thing.
Yeah.
First of all, are all your children like that? Like
they all have special.
It's a supernatural level watching her do characters.
Thank you. And you know, here's the thing. You know, it's kind of like we are all blessed, and if you walk in your purpose, she's been blessed with a lot of talent. I mean, and yes, on the show, she's showing you her character. She can go so deep, you know. Right. Like sometimes I'm blown away. But she's been doing it since she was little, like she was a baby. Like when I used to take them to school, you know, we would play we called it the radio game. And I'd be in the car, and I'll just change the radio station and whatever the music is, and we go to the different stations. And so if it's French, she'd be back there, we'd be going French back and forth. If it was Southern, so good morning. You know, we'd just do characters, British, English, if it sounded like the BBC. So, you know, as a baby, she was doing that. So seeing her on the show, we just have these beautiful moments because I just want her to like I no, because at one point I was really hard on her and I said let me stop because
I was like do you give notes?
I didn't want to be the Joe Jackson of impressions.
Right,
baby,
right.
do that voice again. do that damn voice. You better do Dorothy from the Wizard of Oz. You know, you better learn how to do that. You know. So the thing is that I pulled back and we just have the best because she'll be working on characters and we'll just play. And it's like, you know, it's like. It's like I got a question for you. Like, as musicians, mm-hmm. like for me, like she has a magical thing that she just, you know, like she just lives in that pocket. Mm-hmm. When you're looking at musicians and artists, do they have to have a level of magic that maybe somebody doesn't see? Is there magic involved?
Here's the thing. I possess that magic.
Yes.
And then you got to be careful in how you use it, because one day that magic just wound up being my job. And I didn't realize that even though I channel that magic all the time, I was just, it was to the level, it was so effort, like Steph Curry, like I could phone it in. I could talk to you right now and literally do the same performance I did on record. Like that's how it is. The one thing I could say, like pre-pandemic, was I was not in love with music the way I was in love with it as a kid. Like as a kid, you know, teachers used to play games with me. Like, okay, name all six Commodores in 20 seconds. Okay, Ronald LaPree, Milo Williams, Walter Orange Kings, Lionel Richie, Thomas McCleary. Like I was that guy. And then, like when my fan base would suddenly like approach me and you know there'll be an overzealous guy like, yeah, you know, the Japanese B-side that you did and the remix or whatever. And I'm not saying I was the guy that was easily annoyed. I'm willing to admit now and in hindsight that a lot of my self-deprecation, not deserving it, like I had to maybe create a character where it's like maybe I felt so guilty for the positioning that I'm in that I was willing to psychologically disassociate myself. So like, okay, yeah, I'm like, well, I don't care about this shit. Like, oh man, all right. Or, and, you know, I'll be like, okay, calm down. Or thank you. Just say you're a fan. And I was that person. So I actually had to learn how to be vulnerable again in the pandemic. Cause that's the first time in my adult life that I didn't do anything. Like I've been on stage since I was five with my dad. And then the roots started in high school. And then so I had to learn how to be vulnerable again in order to like actually love playing music. And it's a weird thing. Like it was a passion, then became a job, then became a burden. Huh. Then it just became, I don't want to do this anymore. It became obligation. Like, all right, they need to pay their rent, so I'll still do this. But when you have silence on your hands, like we did with the pandemic, one of the things that my coach therapist said was like, you know, where's the mind state you want to get to? And she suggested to me, like, it sounds to me that you were your happiest with music at the age of 11. So I need you to return to that 11-year-old.
Ooh.
And when you're like holding the world on your shoulders, you know, you're dismissive.
That's
you're
responsibility.
Like, oh man, I don't got time to, you know, I got lives to, you know, take care
but
of.
But that 11-year-old is why you got that. That's
right.
Yeah, yeah.
So I had to allow myself the levity to be an 11-year-old. So now I'm an 11-year-old again. Like I would never be this giddy.
Right, nah,
2015, yeah. You know, yeah, Robert Townsend on the show, no big deal.
Rob, as well, man, like to your point, you asked him about magic, you know what I'm saying? Is there magic, you know, with musicians, you know what I'm saying? And there, it absolutely is. And the thing about us, you know, in our craft, that I, in my career, you know, going through it, you know that magic is elusive, You know what I'm saying? Like, magic is, you feel me? So it's like, if you're working on an album, the thing with our crew, we kind of take is like, all right, if I'm working on a record, you're going to do some records and you're going to have one record that's a 10. That is like, yo, we bodied this shit. Fuck you. We clap. Like, fuck what you talking about. Fuck your opinion. We clap this shit up, right?
Right.
If you're lucky, you, I mean, if you get two 10s on an album, oh my God. But like, you're going to get that one. So for us, the mentality is kind of, to your point, is like, good is the enemy of great.
Yes.
We've been so, we're so technically good at what we do. We can just pull up and do whatever and it'll be good. Fuck good. Good is the minimum. We trying to get greatness. So if you getting a 10 on one record, you feel me? If you got a 10, it's like, okay, we know that's magic. We know that was, you know, that was our Moby Dick. Okay, we caught him one time. But if we got a 10, we can't have nothing else on this album that's less than an 8. Because we've shown that we can hit a 10. So you coming here with these 6 and 7, fuck out of here, bro. Like, that ain't, nah.
See, I feel glory, glory.
Thank you, man.
I feel glory, glory was your return, like, of all your verses and all your
That's what I was literally just thinking. I was like, so therefore, Fonte, what would you recommend to Robert as your 10 album? What's the one?
No, the listening is, and I know, for you, the listening is almost like my things fall apart, like, when people say things fall apart, I'd be like, ah, oh, man, but I've done other albums that's just great. But I understand.
It's just the thing that speaks to the person where they were at that time.
Where they were in their life. What
was my 10?
Yeah, because in my mind, I'm thinking Robert might not really know. He don't know what your 10 sound like, and he should probably know. So I would like to know.
Oh, man, like, I got a 10 for us. I would say on the little brother side, I think... our last album, Made a Lord Watch, that was our first record in like 10 years. And I just developed a skill set, you know, as getting older, working in TV, learning the language of like storytelling, because that's essentially, for me, that's what musicianship is. It's all storytelling.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
And so, you know what I mean? So working in TV, writing songs for TV, writing songs for Sesame Street, doing TV stuff, like that really gave me a whole new skill set in terms of telling stories, and that translated to like my MCing and songwriting. So I would say May Lord Washington, Leave It All Behind, which is the record I did with my other group, Foreign Exchange R&B group. We were now Grammy nominated.
Would you send me all this stuff?
Yes.
Would you send me the
music? Yes. I would say
the perfect gateway drug. He's also being modest and can't be a fan of something he's a part of, but what he represents is kind of like, okay, so Drake has went on record to say that that's his hero. So Fonte came along in a period in which when the internet and social media and the blogosphere was becoming the standard, like for you, it was pounding the pavement, going to these brick and mortar comedy houses, whatever. Whereas now, you can get a whole career based on this machine. He's the first person to really take advantage of what this device had to offer in terms of he's made albums with people he's never met yet in other countries.
Yeah, the record I did, Foreign Exchange, my partner Nicolay at the time, he was living in the Netherlands and I was in North Carolina in Durham. And so we were just on AIM, we were on Instant Messenger, and we would just send tracks through Instant Messenger. And we completed the whole album. We didn't meet until the album was finished, like in person.
You know, and it's not just a record.
It's an artistic piece.
It's a classic album. Yeah. So,
but yeah, the listening.
Please send it to me.
The listening. Yeah. I'll put up there. The connect the album. I'll send you stuff. But I say all that to say, man, you really hearing your story. Like, I don't think you understand, man. Like, you lit a fire. Whether you recognize you do or not, you lit a fire under like so many black creators and black artists that were like, yo, we not waiting. Fuck waiting. We not waiting on somebody to give us a chance. We not waiting. We gonna make the shit we wanna make and figure it out how we gonna do it. And I think now, you know, I mean, a Robert Townsend in 2023, you know what I'm saying? A young guy. There's so many tools now that, you know, you really don't need them to some degree. I mean, unless you're trying to make, you know, fucking something with Iron Man in it, then yeah. But if you're just trying to tell a story that's true to you, if you know how to make it and you got your people, and I really like what you said about how, you know, when Amir was asking about the actors, and it was like, yo, it was my word. Like, that is the exact same way we run it, bro. It's like everybody gets paid. You're going to be compensated. You're going to be shown that you're valued for your time. But if you can't take a person that they were, they signature don't mean
shit. Yes, sir.
So, you know what I mean? So it was just, you really lit a fire under us, man. And like watching Hollywood Shuffle, like I showed that to my kids. My boys are 22 and 17. Like I showed them that movie and they laugh at it. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know what I mean? So inspiration, I can't, is too small of a word. Like, you were a fucking, and are a blueprint for us.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much. Thank you so much. I don't want to take it away.
You gave the final thing.
He's an Aquarius. He can't take all these compliments.
I accept compliments.
Wait. Talk about Robert.
Oh, you're an Aquarian too?
I'm Aquarius too.
Of course you are.
February 6th. When is yours?
January 20th.
Oh, okay.
Yes. Wait, I'm right now making the obligatory phone call that I have to do whenever we do a classic episode. He's not going to pick up. He better pick up.
Who's you?
Jimmy.
Okay.
So, you know, okay, so he's not going to pick up. Whenever we do an exemplary classic episode of Questlove Supreme, I have to let Jimmy Jam know that he's going down a rank.
It took him six hours.
Jimmy Jam was a six. It was supposed to be 90 minutes. It wound up being three episodes. Jimmy, but then the Family Stand came in and did the most unexpected episode of all time. This to me, I'm willing to say this is probably the episode I needed.
Yeah. Nah, we all need it. For real.
Jimmy Jam is now in third place. Sorry,
Jimmy Jam. Control is still a great album.
Yes, exactly.
It wasn't the bold, the black, and the beautiful.
Hold on. One of my favorite scenes I have to do is for... Come on, man. We left you alone thinking you was going to leave that drinking and drug shit before. We left you alone thinking you was going to calm down. Like, yo, Harry Lennox. Like,
Harry Lennox.
Bro. Like, I love that scene,
thank
man.
You.
Well,
thank you.
And, Hawthorne James. God, just the actors, man.
Hawthorne James.
Oh, my God. Big Red, like.
No,
I
saw him doing Shakespeare at the
He does Shakespeare?
I could see that.
Oh, yeah.
He
was doing Macbeth. And he was, I think, not master, you know. And I was like, this guy could be a bad guy, really good. You know, I mean, he's a brilliant
actor.
Now,
your eye for talent, man, is like, seriously, like, we salute you, bro.
Unpaid Bill, you missed a masterpiece today.
Man, listen.
I cannot wait to gloat.
Are you still in contact with Anne-Marie? Because we're looking for her to give her some flowers, too.
I haven't talked to her, but I can get, you know, because she did. They just released Hollywood Shuffle on the Criterion Collection.
Yes, they did.
And they did with Anne-Marie. So I can reach out. So, I can get I can get you her number.
Well, on behalf of Fontigolo, Sugar Steve, Laia, and I'm P. Bill, bruh, I'm sorry.
Yo, Robert, that one episode of MASH, man.
Robert Townsend, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much. We'll see you on the next round of Questlove Supreme. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Questlove Supreme. This podcast is hosted by Amir Questlove Thompson, Laia St. Clair, Fonte Coleman, Sugar Steve Mandel, and myself, Unpaid Bill Sherman. The executive producers are Amir, just walked into the goddamn room, Thompson, Sean G, and Brian Calhoun. Produced by Brittany Benjamin, Jake Payne, and Laia St. Clair. Edited by Alex Conroy. I know Alex Conroy. Produced for iHeart by Noel Brown and Mike John. Auto engineering by Graham Gibson at iHeart's LA studio. Thank you very much.
Questlove Supreme is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
With every CBD product claiming to do something different, it's nearly impossible to decide what's best for you. Lazarus Naturals pioneered the farm-to-front-door model of transparency where they handle each step of the production process to ensure quality, potency, and consistency. Scannable labels allow you to see the test results of your hemp batch so you can be confident in the safety and quality. Visit LazarusNaturals.com today. Lazarus Naturals, committed to improving your life as well as the world around you. Not available in Idaho, Iowa, or South Dakota.
What do the most successful growing businesses have in common? They're working together in Slack. Slack is where work happens, with all your people, data, and information in one AI-powered place. Grow your business in Slack. Visit slack.com to get started.
Let's clear out winter and clean up the lawn with Spring Black Friday savings at the Home Depot. Right now, get the Ryobi One Plus leaf blower for just $89 and make your lawn work easier with a powerful 90 miles an hour of clearing power. And with convenient online shopping, you can order on the app, pick up in store, and get outside sooner. Get your yard spring ready with the Ryobi One Plus leaf blower, now just $89 during Spring Black Friday at the Home Depot. How doers get more done.